Welcome to the Quintessential Listening Poetry Online Radio and YouTube Podcast, streamed live from the heart of Washington, D.C. Here, you'll find a portal to vibrant voices, echoing souls, and an ongoing celebration of the extraordinary power of language. So, prepare yourself to join host Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram and his special guests as they explore traditional and spoken word forms of poetry.
My special guest on May 13th, 2024 was Mike Jerkovic. Mike is a globally published poet with collections like Buckshot Reckoning, Moon Cussers, and American Mental. His work has appeared in several anthologies, including the Calling All Poets 20th Anniversary Anthology. He is president of Calling All Poets in New Paltz, New York, and was nominated for a 2016 Pushcart Prize. He also reviews CDs for All About Jazz and LightwoodPress.com. He co-chaired the Music Fan Series at Rosendale Theater and hosts new jazz excursions on WVKR 91. 3FM, it was a pleasure to welcome Mike to the podcast. Take a listen.
Let's begin this poetic journey. What is poetry?
It's communication. It's an oral history. I mean, we all get to a point where we need to hear our histories either reflected back to ourselves or reflected outwards from ourselves. And poetry is that way. Poetry has been since the dawn of man, the way that people communicate. It's in the cadence of the way you speak. It's in the rhythm of the music. It's in the rhythm of the words. It's all around us. All the great books of our religions are poetry. All our scriptures are poetry. All our songs are poetry. The great orators all the way down the line, Martin Luther King, Kennedy, you name it, even folks that I can't even think of, all great orators had some form of cadence that gave their words more power. I mean, sadly, even goes for our dictators and the bad people that we can't stand, because there is power in words, and the way you say them, the way you sing them, the way you reflect upon them, it all becomes this history. It all becomes this forward movement.
So for you, Mike, the musicality of words is very important.
I always work on rhythm-based, always. I've worked with a lot of musicians in my day, and one of the reasons that they've appreciated working with me is the rhythm that I bring to the words. And I'm like, well, if I don't have rhythm to the words, what rhythm are you going to have? And vice versa. Right. So I've worked with jazz guys. I've worked with a lot of rock and roll guys, and it's always, okay, yeah, how can we fit this into a 4-4? How can we fit this into some kind of blues? How can we do it? And you work it out. You make it, everything comes to it. Okay. Everything comes with its own rhythm, its own, I'm going to repeat cadence again, but its own cadence, yeah. Well, I've done a lot of work with musicians. One of the things we do here is at jazz poetry events, and we work with musicians a lot. And I've got several rock and roll guys that it's like, come on, let's go do something. So we'll go do something. And it's just, there's always music to it somehow.
So Mike, based on what you know about the world, your lived experience, there are those out there who believe poetry is dying, that it's not what it once was. What are your views on this topic? And more importantly, is poetry still important?
Yeah, I think what it is it's a real misunderstanding by people and quite possibly the poets themselves. Because again, there's poetry everywhere. You go to church, there's poetry. You go to the temple, there's poetry. You want to apologize to the missus for, I don't know, effing up somehow. You go get a card. The card has poetry in it. Every song you listen to has got some form of poetry. Not necessarily good, but it's got poetry to it. So there's a lyricism to it. Poetry is all around us. It's just, I think we started to take it for granted. And it's like, well, it must be dying because I don't see it anymore, but it's right in front of you. It's always right there in front of you. I mean, even if you say the smallest prayer in a day, If you catch yourself praying, it's a poem. So it's not that it's dying. I just think people take it for granted.
Right. Nicely phrased, Mike. Please share with me an early experience when you learned that poetic language had power.
I think most people my age go right back to Bob Dylan or the Beatles, on Sam Cooke. I mean, all the great Motown folks that were writing. The poetry was there. Mr. Tambourine Man, Blueberry Hill. I mean, it's all there. It says, My Girl. I mean, does anything get more poetic than My Girl? I would have to say it was Dylan, Motown, the Beatles. And then you stretch it out from there, which is what I did. I mean, in all honesty, when I first heard Mr. Tambourine Man, maybe I was 14, 13, something like that. And I got nauseous. The words were spinning around like crazy. And I just remember getting up out of my bed and just like, whoa, what was that? So my first poetic experience was nausea. But I mean, that's how that Mr. Tambourine Man just smashed me in the face. And I was just like, that's it. I got to look into what this is all about. Even when you read it, because, I mean, Dylan's got several large volumes of the lyrics. And even when you read it, you're captivated by it. It's just to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free. Yeah, I think that's what we all hope for at some point. That, I admit it, it made me nauseous at first, but then once that cleared away, it was like, yeah, that's right.
So when you think about writing poetry, what do you write about? What are some of the predominant themes of your work?
Well, my wife would tell you that love poems are not my strength. So I try to keep the love end of things in haikus because I can't get into any trouble with 17 syllables. I can keep that pretty straight ahead. I write about political stuff. I try to stay, I write with humor. I like writing with humor. I don't think there's enough humor, although it's growing. It seems to be growing as new poets get into it, like Billy Collins, Tony Hoagland. They started bringing more and more humor to it. So I try to put some kind of humor, even a slight bit of sarcasm to it. But I write politically. I write about if something strikes me, I'll write it. Well, at least I'll try and interpret it one way, shape, form, or another. It doesn't mean I'll be successful, but I'll try. And I like to throw in historical references because I do enjoy reading American history, world history. And so if I can find a place where I can throw something in like that, I'll do that. But it's predominantly current issues, I would say.
All great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours and what makes them great in your eyes? Now, we've talked about Bob Dylan. Who else is out there?
Well, strangely enough, I don't really read too much poetry, although there are a lot of friends and fellow poets that are always giving me something or telling me, you got to read this one, you got to read that one. I started going into this mostly by reading Steinbeck, Ursula Le Guin, Flannery O'Connor, Jack Kerouac. I think one of the first earlier poets that I actually did start to read with any real besides Kerouac would have been Allen Ginsberg. Kenneth Patchen was another one. Kurt Vonnegut was a huge influence on him. I mean, there's just no two ways around that. And he didn't write any poetry. At least we didn't consider it poetry. And there was a novelist. Her name was Ann Tyler. She wrote The Homesick Restaurant, Return to the Homesick Restaurant, whatever that was. And Ladder of Years and things of that nature. And Steinbeck, East of Eden. I mean, these are just great things. And when I really got interested in writing, it was mostly through the novelists, through the fiction writers and stuff. And then I started reading the poets and that kind of stuff.
Please share a poem.
All right. Like I said, I like doing stuff historical. And this is called The Irreversible Future. We oohed and awed at the 64 World's Fair and the droids that would take away our work and give us more time with the kids, more time to smoke, to read and watch,
to drain blood. And they cough some more.
Raw metallic arms did the work of 50 men without unions and overtime. Hulking huge brains sprayed pretty light and reasoned all our equations. The atom had no blowback. The wonderful world of chemistry was just one pill away. We marveled at modems and picture phones. Big Oil gave us dinosaurs. The happy plastic family heartened us all. Different trips, same monkey, Disney ruled the air. Weather stations under the Arctic ice would correct the world's climate. The cities of the future had no ghetto that we could see. They were less sad and frantic than those to come. No one homeless. No one alone. Jetpacks. Space stations. The deserts turned into farms where robots picked the fruit. The Mick was there. I saw him amid the supercars, the Kennedys without Jack, for the darkness did just dawn. We oohed and awed, zipping on the monorail, carrying our radiated nickels and dimes. Or were they pennies? I forgot all about the poor. We explored the mysteries of a woman's mind. Wisconsin cheese. 3D led to 4G, led to 5. They say we don't need 6. We oohed and awed and became. That's the end.
Very nice. Please tell me about the purpose of that piece. Why did you write it?
I have to admit that that was one of those ones that I'm not even sure it had a purpose. It just came to me one day. I literally wrote it on a manila folder, one of the things that you use to put papers in. It was sitting here on the table, and I was just like, it was just a reflection on the 64 World's Fair. I couldn't, maybe if you asked me about a couple of the others, I might actually have a better answer for you, but I really don't have one on that one. That one just came out of the blue. That's one of those ones that really can't explain.
What are some of the lines in that particular poem that you feel really proud about writing?
Well, I do like the whole thing about the oohing and aahing at the 64 World's Fair. I do like the idea of the wonderful world of chemistry being just one pill ahead. The space stations and jetpacks and the deserts. And the idea of seeing Mickey Mantle because I really did see Mickey Mantle at the 64 World's Fair. I did not see the Kennedys, but we knew they attended. And just the line repeating it again, that we oohed and aahed and then eventually became those people. And that, I think that's the killer one for me right there.
Conversely, what about lines that challenged you the most to write?
I think the real challenge of that one especially is that it has to be performed in that air of being that kid at the World's Fair and spending belief that all this stuff is eventually going to come to reality and we're all going to have flying cars and all that stuff. And then to come to the end of it and realize, well, I really think that one, if there was one that really needed to be performed properly for the listeners to understand it, I think that's the one, or one of them.
You know, Mike, as I listened, there is so much happening in that poem. There seem to be two poles. One, where there are all these beautiful things, cotton candy bright, in a sense. And then there's the other world where I forgot about poor people, I think is the line. And it makes me wonder, does it hurt you to write poetry? If not, why not?
No, we didn't see the poor because the great big cities of the future weren't going to have anybody. Right. We weren't going to have any homeless, or at least you weren't going to see them.
Right.
And I mean, that too is part of the illusion of the poem because there's just no way you're not going to see them. Does it hurt me? That's a tough one. I honestly don't know. Does it hurt? I think sometimes the subject might. Okay. Because, I mean, nobody wants to be a downer all the time. But no, I don't really know if there's... No, I can't really say that hurt. No. I'm not sure, honestly. I'm not sure. No, I don't think hurt's the right word. I think the realization is the thing that might cause discomfort. Whether it hurts, I'm not sure. Or okay. Whether I'm trying to skim a line here either, I'm not sure.
Second part of that question is, are you willing to be hurt by the poetry of others? If not, why not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the only way we're going to get moved one way, shape, form, or another. And again, that goes back to the communication. You might be reading something to me, and it's going to hit a familiar note. It might hit a familiar funny note. It might hit a familiar discomforting note. It might hit something that really does hurt. But that's the chance you take. I mean, that's the chance we take as word people. But I also think that's the chance that people take in all kinds of art. I mean, there's a lot of people that just want to be disruptors. I think we do need to do that to some point. But to necessarily do it, I'm not too sure about that.
Please share another poem.
All right, how about something a little lighter? This one's kind of based on a true story. And this is called Just Two Guys on the Astral Plane. How'd you get here so fast? St. Peter asks. So I say, I had a 7-mile jump on all the rest. We were 38,000 feet above Charlotte, I say, knowing full well he knew full well and was testing my wiry candor. I know it was the wine, I say. He then quoted the heavenly manual. You come when you're called and you wait in the queue. But I'm here now if ever I was, I say. My blood pressure cuff still tied on my arm, my shoes untied, my shirt undone, my hair a quiff of its former coif. Hey, Pete, I say, unrepentant, we're just two guys on the astral plane rooting for the same team. So come on, come on. Just what did the big man say? You're in, he said. Now wait right there.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I think I'd like you to read that one again for me, please.
Okay. And like I said, it's based on a true story because I really did have this incident on an airplane above Charlotte. And this is called right. Just Two Guys on the Astral Plane. How'd you get here so fast, St. Pete asks. So I say, I had a 7-mile jump on all the rest. We were 38,000 feet above Cap Charlotte, I say. Knowing full well, he knew full well, and was testing my wiry candor. He then quoted the heavenly manual. You come when you're called and wait in the queue. But I'm here now if ever I was, I say. My blood pressure cuff still tied on my arm, my shoes untied, my shirt undone, my hair a quiff of its former coif. Hey, Pete, I say, unrepentant. We're just two guys on the astral plane rooting for the same team. So, come on, buddy. Just what did the big man say? You're in, he said. Now wait right there. That really was a true story. That came from, we were traveling out west and we were on a plane to Charlotte for a layover in Charlotte for a couple of hours. And the plane just started spinning on me, and my blood pressure dropped like crazy. And fortunately, there was an emergency room doctor sitting right behind us. And she just jumped into action, told the stewardesses what to do, told me to lay flat. And they got me out, went to Charlotte Medical Center and all kinds of stuff. And I came on that next day. But, wow. And that came from that. So that's where I like to add humor into things. Here's somebody home. Here I am almost dying. I almost get a laugh out of it. Mm-hmm.
Mike, you've worked with a number of poets. What do you think makes poets different from other people?
Their voice, for one. And by voice, I mean, that encompasses their ideas, their outlook on things. It encompasses their history. There are some great poets here in the Hudson Valley that I've had a great privilege to work with. And each one is different. We have different deliveries. I mean, some deliveries might kind of lull you into a sleepy little affect, maybe. But others will wake you up and keep you on the edge of your seat. Others will keep you not necessarily laughing, but keep you in a light frame of mind. Yeah, and you always learn from one another. No matter what the voice is, you're gonna learn something. Because it's like, oh yeah, wait, I could have done that.
So when you think about your work, your body of work, what makes your work unique? I know that it's Mike Jerkovic's work. Well, what else makes it unique?
Yeah. I think it's very accessible. I think anybody who's ever had even a minor health crisis could relate to something like that, to the last poem I just read. I think my stuff is very accessible. It could be a doubter sometimes, but I think it's the accessibility of it. I do like to perform it so you become a part of also, right, or a listener becomes a part of also.
Mike, I agree with you 100%. The listener should become a part of it as well. I've always believed if you wrote it, you should live it. That, to me, is why performance is so important. Hearing it is critical.
And one of the things that I do include with the books is I always make some kind of audio CD with it. So while you're reading it, you can also hear it. As I said, I work with the musicians, so I get lucky with them, and they'll be like, yeah, come on, let's do something. And so I like to try and include an audio CD with music behind it or sound effects or something, just so that people can get the idea. Because if you do it right, it will jump off the page no matter what.
Yes.
And I think we all strive to do that. But with that little kick behind it with the audio, and that works.
Please share some more of your work.
All right, let's see. Where are we going? How about this one? I can only speak for myself, but I'm really amazed when women have everything in their purse. And this is called Eleanor's purse. Eleanor's purse held many things. Everyone's prone to the shivers and yips, she says, curating her bag with a passion few possess. This here's for bloating, she'd puff, holding a change of face and coin, one small vial, two orange pills, three sets of 60, four counts of felony, five minor headaches, six Christmas trees, seven separate somethings, eight triple ply, nine bold remarks, 10 turtle doves, 11 assorted mints, 12 novellas, and you lose at least 90 minutes of your life stuck in traffic each day. She'd insist, no stranger to the truth, but not quite its kin. God wields without partiality, she'd note, handing you a hammer. And all that stuff you find in their purse.
With the theme of driving and traffic, so what I'd like to know is, when a poem is being written, who's driving, you or the poem? Who is in the driver's seat?
I write very freely. I won't try to direct the idea. I'll just let the idea go as far as it can go. And if I feel like editing at that time and place, I'll do it. If I don't, I'll come back to it. And I'll look and see, wow, okay, that line's pretty good. Yeah, that idea's pretty good. Okay, that's scrapped that. I mean, even when you're reading it sometimes, this Eleanor's purse is, I don't know, maybe 3 years old. I can't even remember which of those books it's in back there. But reading it, I still managed to cut two or three words out of it. because the poem is always evolving at some point. And editing on the fly, I think, is just one part of my process.
Speaking of editing, some poets claim that a poem is like a living creature. And once it's out there, there's not much you can do to correct and or improve it. While others edit meticulously, not leaving much from the original draft form. What is your take on the editing process?
I think I sort of agree with you're constantly editing all the way down. I mean, every time you look at the poem, you got to edit something because something's going to stick in your craw. And especially me, who really likes to read them out loud and, as we said, perform them. It's like, no, not that one. And you edit on the fly. I edit a lot. That's why I like doing haikus, because sometimes there's just too many words. And you're either going to get in trouble or it's going to stink. And I would prefer not getting in trouble and that it didn't stink. So if I can cut it down to 17 syllables, I'm really happy. I believe the number one, I guess, rule, maybe for lack of a better word, would be editing. Always it. I don't care who you are, always it.
What moves you to write a poem? What is the core impulse in general for you to write poetry?
Well, although I haven't done much this year due to various issues here at home, I love going out hiking, so I'll write while I'm hiking. I do, on occasion, take a little nip of something, and that'll bring some ideas around, and you start writing them all down. But to defend myself that way, I'll let the ideas flow after I've taken that nip, okay? I will edit straight. I'll edit totally, you know, with what the piece can be in mind or what the piece wants to be in mind. And I do like driving and writing. I've got notebooks of scribble that I'm still trying to decipher. It's just me writing like this. And I know it's very easy to just talk into the cell phone now if you want to do it that way. But as much as I like the sound of my voice when we can produce it properly, I can't stand the sound of my voice when it's not produced properly. I don't do that. I'll just sit with the book on my side, right, left hand on the wheel, 60 miles an hour, writing something, and then decipher it as we go along.
Mike, I'd like you to imagine for a moment that we're baking a cake. The cake is the poem. What are some of the ingredients that would go into the making of a poem?
I'm looking for the word. Not necessarily the time of day, but the type of day that you're having. Okay. And how do you go on, right. How the interpretation of the day, let's say it that way, the interpretation of the day goes into it. No matter how hard you try, I mean, even something like Eleanor's Purse, I mean, there's some bit of history, personal history in everything. So a little bit of history is going to go in. A little bit of current affairs is going to go in. Like I mentioned before, I love trying to bring humor to it. So there's always going to be some little sprinkly humor in there somewhere. Now we need some spices. What would be a cinnamon or something? I don't know. What would you put in the cake after I've put that in?
Now, you know that in an interview, you're not supposed to turn it back on the host. But I think what I would do, I would put part of myself in it somehow. Part of me.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's a little bit of history that I was saying. Or your current self. No, absolutely. I mean, that's where our voice comes from. It comes from what we are on any given day. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'll let you in on a secret. Some of these poetry contests that are based on themes and stuff. I never do that. I can't do themes. How do I know what one is and what one isn't? I can't lock it into that type of thing. That's not fair to me for one, and it's not fair to the poem for another. So I never get involved in these theme things.
Mike, they say that to see the world with complete honesty, one should look to comedians, artists, musicians, and poets. So Mike, when you write, what emerges naturally from you?
you're going to find a human being doing his best to figure it out like we all are.
Okay.
But this is the way I've decided to try and figure it out. I've decided to figure it out by scribbling on a page and say, hey, here's where I was at this particular time. This is how I felt about a certain something at this particular time. Is it alien to anybody? I doubt it, because we are all one. So we all feel the same way, not necessarily, maybe we won't interpret it the same way, but we all do go through the same experiences. And that's what I think you find. That's what I hope you find.
That's the definition of empathy. Our lived experiences may be different, but our feelings are the same. And there's a universal commonality in terms of our feelings. And that's where you build that bridge in terms of understanding another person. Wow. Wow. I like your thinking.
Our adventures, my adventure in life, I'm sure in one way, shape for or another, comes close to yours. And yours comes close to mine.
Yes.
That's what makes us human.
In this world we live in, there's good, there's bad, there's ugly, as well as indifference. What do you view as being the role of a poet in modern day society?
Don't be indifferent. That's really it. Indifference to me is just, it's poison. Now, if you're going to be indifferent about the music that you're writing, or the painting, or the photography, or the sculpture that you're making, or the poem, or the novel, or the flash fiction, or whatever the heck it is, why are you doing it then? If you're indifferent about it, I have to feel that if you're indifferent about any piece of art that you're creating, I can't help but feel that someone somewhere is going to know you were indifferent when you did that and not paying any attention. And what is the point of trying to write these things or paint these things if no one's going to pay attention? I understand it can be used as a personal therapy. I do it myself. But I mean, if you're getting it out there, if you're doing exhibits and you're doing readings and you're doing concerts, why do you want to be indifferent? If you're indifferent, the people that are listening are going to be indifferent. The people that are coming to the concerts are going to be indifferent. So indifference breeds indifference, and it just doesn't amount to anything. It's just, don't bother doing it. Go, I don't know, go make shoes or something. Do something else. Instead of painting your indifference, that's going to make somebody else feel indifferent. I don't know. Do something else. Find another line of work or something.
Mike, we live in such a tough world. As poets, are we required to write about this tough world? Why can't I just write about the ocean, hush puppy shoes, I don't know, and leave the rest to other people to deal with?
Yes, absolutely. Because down through the ages, people have looked to artists of every discipline, to show them the way, or to get them through the day, or to show them that there is something out there that's better, or if it's not better, it's at least... Well, now I don't want to contradict myself. All right, so not necessarily... Yeah. That there is something better. And whether it's out there or it's in you, that's what the artists have always been relied on and called upon to do, was to show us a better way. And I think it's up to all of us to do that. And if we have to do that sometimes by writing about how horrible it is, then some people need to wake up as to exactly how horrible it is, because it is horrible. And it's getting worse. And I feel sorry for people that don't realize that. So, yeah, it's up to us. It's up to everyone who considers themselves an artist, I don't care what the discipline is, to reflect the world and broadcast it back out that, look, you can have a hand in making this thing better. So however we do that, whether it's through humor, whether it's through a beautiful portrait of a married couple or a beautiful girl portrait or someone's favorite dog or something, whatever the case might be, something that brings a little bit of light and beauty into the partaker's life, that's what we're meant to do.
Mike, it's time to hear more of your work. This time, please share two poems.
All right. Oh, man, you're making it tough there. Where do we do? We'll do this one. We'll do these two. Before we got started, we were both talking about being old men. So I know, I'm sure you did your share of commuting. I did mine.
Yes. Yes.
This is one of those poems about commuting, and it's called Tell Them, My Love. If they ask, my dear, tell them I died behind the wheel, waiting for the light to turn, waiting for the nitwit ahead of me to discover his left foot from his right. Tell them, my love, I died simpering while the road crew widened thoroughfares and smoothed the finish over my blackened heart. Tell them, my love, should any be inclined to query of my well-being, that I'm buried with the odometer, the universal gear. Tell them I withered in the heat, the stewing froth of motion and mediocrity, prey to the rush and clatter, the zooming, zoom, 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 zoom of death. Tell them, my love, I died in love with you, with them, despite the miles between us, wishing I was home. And this has become an all-time favorite of mine. I hate to say it's one of my greatest hits, but I think it is. And this is called
Save
Gracie.
Anyway.
This is called Gracie. There's a grammatical error up ahead that will change everything. How and why, I don't know, because off the top of my head, each mad essay must cast doubt on the one before, or at least lend a hand to its aberrant cause, which makes for unsure seasons, rising seas, and a lack of wonder. And I know, I do, I really do know that you all have better places to be, like Dunkin' Donuts or Debtor's Jail. So I'll try to get to what I'm getting at before I get to where I'm going, which was to talk about Gracie Allen, who knew that today's postage stamp was yesterday's head of state, that a country of checks and balances relies heavily on them checks, and that you never place a comma where God has put a period. And
I'd like to hear that one again. Please share it one more time.
Oh, cool. Okay.
You don't mind?
Gracie. There's a grammatical error up ahead that will change everything. How and why, I don't know, because off the top of my head, each mad essay must cast doubt on the one before, or at least lend a hand to its aberrant cause, which makes for unsure season, rising seas, and a lack of wonder. And I know, I truly, truly do know that you all have better places to be, like Dunkin' Donuts or Debtor's Jail. So I'll get to what I'm getting at before I get to where I'm going, which was to talk about Gracie Allen, who knew that today's postage stamp was yesterday's head of state, that a country of checks and balances relies heavily on those checks, and that you never place a comma where God has put a period.
That's an incredible poem. Please share some of the lines that you felt most proud of writing.
Well, I have to admit, I really do like, I know you have better places to be, like Dunkin' Donuts or Debtor's Jail. I like that one. As a matter of fact, when I came up with that one, I was like, wow, that's really kind of neat. But I do like that one. And I do like, you never place a comma where God has put a period.
That's a good one. That's a real good one. I like that.
And,
that's a real good one.
and the grammatical error up ahead that will change everything. I liked it. That as an introduction to a piece, I was like, oh yeah, that works. Okay. And so I liked that. But I think if I had to pick, if I had to pick my favorite line, it's the Dunkin' Donuts or Dennis channel. I have no idea where.
What about lines in that particular poem that challenged you the most? The craft.
What would happen was, is I am a really a big fan of Gracie Allen. I think she was one of the greatest comedians of all. I mean, there was nothing you could put past that woman. Nothing. And when I started to write this and wanted it to have some relationship to Gracie Allen, I started going through Gracie Allen quotes and stuff to that nature. And mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, she's full of them. And I thought one better than the other. And I'm like, Jesus, man, what am I going to do here? So it was really a matter of just trying to find the rhythm of them properly. The postage stamp yesterday said of state, the country of checks and balances relies on checks, which we all know anyway. And a comma and God put a period was just, for me, perfect. And I was just like, that's it.
Because you are a poet who also likes to perform your work, what do you think is the relationship between your reading voice and your written voice?
Oh, man. The relationship between my reading voice and my written voice and the reading voice, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm not too I think they blend well together. I think what I write sounds good as I'm reading it. And I think while I'm reading it, it looks good while I'm saying it. If that makes any sense at all. I do. I think one lends to the other and they blend together. I've always been very extroverted and always ready to not necessarily take center stage, but to wait my turn and then take it. But yeah, so... Yeah, I've just never been shy. If I have a feeling that what I've written is good, then I'm going to let people know that I know that it's good. And I think the best way to do that is with an expressive reading style. So it almost becomes out like I guess you could say it's almost like a salute. Yeah.
That in mind, please tell me about a poem you were proud of writing, but afraid to share for fear of misinterpretation.
There was one. That it's really weird that you asked that question. I've only performed it once. And I don't really know if I'm afraid to do it, but I just don't know if it needs a place for. We have 18 acres out here, my wife and I. And not that I mow all 18 acres or landscape all 18 acres, but there's a lot of property out here. So you try and make it look nice and this type of thing. It doesn't. It's pretty raggedy, but it looks cool ragged. So I guess that's a way to put it. And there was this one time, one day I was outside many years ago. I think we had just moved in here. And I was leaf blowing or leaf whacking or something. And this whole idea, the stereotypical thing with the Mexican laborers. And all of a sudden I got this crazy idea about, oh, I'm letting out my inner Mexican. And I meant it. I meant it sarcastically. My inner Mexicans here working on it. I can't even remember the piece. So the local magazine, I sent it to one of the local magazines. And one of the local magazines printed it. So I was doing a reading here in the area at that time. And this person walks up to me and she goes, "You're the last person that I would have thought would be a racist." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And she goes, "That poem, you're making fun of the Mexicans." I said, "I'm not making any fun of the Mexicans." I said, "It's meant to be sarcastic. It was never meant." So I just dropped down. Forget it. I don't want to get into any confrontations in any way. I could send it to you if you want to see it, if I could find it. But I think that's the one. That would be the one. Yep. That's it. That's about 20 years old now, not older.
And you never shared it again?
No, I read it that one time. That person had read it in the magazine. And when she came up and accused me of being a racist, I was like, okay, someone's not getting the joke. And yeah, it's not worth it. It tickles my funny bone anyway, the idea of an intermixing. And it was, again, it was meant to be sarcastic, and it just didn't work out that way. So, all right, I dropped it.
Well,
fortunately, there have been better ones.
So if you could have been born in another time period as a poet, when would you have wanted to live?
I think the 40s and 50s with the Beats.
Really?
I have an affinity with the Beats. I just do. My wife doesn't understand it because she's one of the romantics. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't take that. So, but I would be with the Beats. I've been lucky. You might recognize the name David Amram. Wonderful player. He played with Mingus. He played with this one. I count him as a good friend. And it was basically him and Jack Kerouac that started the whole idea of music and jazz and poetry together. And to have been in on something like that at that point, I would have loved being there. Absolutely. That would have been my year.
Share with me what you think you would have brought that period. Something that would have been distinctly Mike Jerkoffy.
I would say it would probably be the sense of humor. Because Ginsberg had a sense of humor, but he could put people off real quick. I truly don't believe my sense of humor, except for that one poem. I don't think my humor puts people off. To have been able to sit down and write with Gary Snyder, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, or any of those guys, to me, just would have been awesome. Yeah. So I think my sense of humor would have
set you apart.
Yeah.
Here's a random question. Do poems change color in certain lights?
I don't know necessarily in certain light, but I think after, like, if you've been reading something, let's say 5 or 10 years ago, and you haven't read it for a long time, and then all of a sudden you're reading it now, I think that would put it in a new light, yeah. I think it would change color there, because you've changed, God knows how many colors you've changed in the interim.
Mike, you've written books. You've been in anthologies. You've hosted poetry programs, plus countless other poetic activities. When does your poetic doubt set in?
My poetic doubt?
Yes.
That's really funny you asked that one, because except for that poem about the two guys on the astral plane in St. Peter, I think I'm going through a lot of poetic doubt right now. I have not, except for a large handful of haikus, which I post up on book with an image that I've created quite frequently, and my reviews for All About Jazz, I have not written a poem in easily 3 months. That's rare for me. I normally, whether they're any good or not, I don't know, but I'll usually kick out 2 or 3 a week, and to not do anything in 3 months is kind of weird.
Why haven't you written anything?
I don't know. I work with, we spoke about Mary Louise before, and we spoke about Amanda, and we're in a workshop together. We're a Zoom salon. And we're always talking. Oh, you're celebrating this one getting accepted. Celebrating this one getting accepted. That one getting accepted. And I haven't had any acceptances. And all of a sudden, it's just like, what? If no one's going to accept me, what do I care if I'm writing or not? So it'll pass. But at the moment, I think that is the main dam, as you would say, as we might say, that's blocking me.
So you're saying that you haven't had recent acceptances or no acceptances at all?
I haven't had any recent ones. I haven't had any in about a year or so. And so, I mean, you start to poetic doubt. Yeah, you start to say, well, and what's changed is that we all want readers, right?
Yes.
And we all want people to comment on what it is that we've written. And I noticed that doing the haikus and pasting them up on Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that, I'm getting at least 100 readers a week.
Wow.
The people saying, hey, man, this is really neat, whatever, beautiful, however, whatever they want to say. And the reviews that I write for All About Jazz, within a month, they'll get about 2,000 readers a month.
Wow.
For my reviews. And I'll post like 4 or 5 a month. So I'm getting readers, and that's what I feel good about. Okay. So it's like, okay, if the editors aren't going to accept me, give them a middle finger and go right directly to the audience and let them say what they want. And that's what I've been doing. I know I'll snap out of it eventually.
I understand. I really understand. We're human first, which means that we're prone to feel doubt. When I think about someone else's success, the old adage about the grass being greener on the other side always comes to mind. And I remember what my grandma said one time. She said, Michael, don't forget that grass is sometimes painted green. So I'm learning to take some deep breaths, calm down, and say, I'm okay. Everything is going to be all right.
One of the folks that's in the salon is always like, you're always just, I make light of the haikus. I don't really count them as being, for whatever reason, and that's my flaw. As part of the whole poetic expression, right? So then I'm concentrating on them and getting people right reading them. Okay, that's another form of expression. That's fine. It's good. Will I eventually snap out of this? Yeah, you always do. Hopefully. Right. But you always do. I mean,
well,
it'll come.
But it's okay to go through it.
Besides, this could get, it might actually, and who knows where that point of getting back into it will come from. Maybe I'll just start going through some of the duds and saying, oh, I can do better than that, and fix them up or something of that nature. So you never know.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting question, the poetic doubt. That's really, you pulled that one out of the hat. That was perfect. And yeah. At first, when you asked it, I was like, oh, man, what is that? And then I was like, oh, wait. Okay.
You know, I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with me, being open and honest about poetic doubt. That's huge. So I appreciate that. I really, really, really do. Now, I don't want to keep you here forever. I'd like to, because I'm enjoying this conversation more than you know. But we've reached my favorite part of the program, which I view as being a mini poetry concert. This is an opportunity for you to share 3 or 4 of your works back to back without interruption from me. I know you love the stage. Mike, the stage is yours.
This is called Fork Misplaced. In this shanty hut of memory, I put down my things, prepare tea, a bowl of green, arrange my space into the same order. Kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, den, a small room for secrets. My desk skewing east, the bed aligned, shoes missing, fork misplaced. This is entitled One of Them. A certain suburban gonad twister in a scorpion made by the house next door, and there's no playing field long enough, no playing field wide enough to escape his agitation. The mechanical slur of his fictional lawn, his new rude machine that cuts the land his imperial way. He's one of those gearheads who RPM and rev you awake every Saturday 8 a.m. Hoards launch jockeys and talks to his tools. Yeah, he's one of them. Why, I wouldn't have dreamed to call one of them that weekend at Woodstock, Newport, Monterey. Marty's 81, has a parched post-pneumonia cough and the shits from diverticulitis. A blood clot in his leg he can't afford the apixapan for because he can't survive Social Security no more. Lives with his daughter in a shit-lorn town in the Hudson Valley that everyone struggles to avoid lest you're driving in a funeral procession because his third wife, Peggy, the folk, a very smart girl, took to the booze in the old farmhouse they rehabbed somewhere in Shilorn, Pennsylvania. 28 years, he counts. 28 years. At Carnegie Hall as a child and sang doo-wop with the mafia boys back there in Bensonhurst. Bought his first vet in 59, a turquoise baby that stole your heart while Sal the Snake stole your wallet. Shows me pictures on his cell phone, his whole life in his hands, in the hands of strangers. The old stone house he restored with Joan, his second wife, who's that fine kid and took on my three. Plays piano for St. Margaret's down the road, Chicken Lauren, at the intersection where the lights don't work. The 62 Corvette, the 65. People were worth something then, he rasps. The cold phlegm seizing his pipes. Shows me his cousin Maury's place up in Saratoga, who raises horses and runs a marina on Manhasset Bay. Maury was a voice. Marlon, he swears, scraping his lungs. More pictures of grandkids and horses, cars and pianos. His fiction shop where he still fixes vintage stereo equipment. I take in a piece here and there, he says, for pocket money. I tell him about my Macintosh with the fried left channel.
It's by email.
Send me some pictures, maybe I can help you out, he says. Served in the service, but that don't mean a damn no more. His son's got his Hunter Green 74 vet until he can get a place of his own. Pictures of his daughter's daughter who just turned 4.
I'm going to start her on scales when this cough's all gone.
Penny diddy now, he says. This is called Blood Street. This poem was actually meant to be a romantic poem because Emily and I were out on the out in the red light district in Amsterdam, and she got a text from my cousin who was sitting in the house about something, and I got a message from a friend of mine in Albany that a poet that we both known who had been missing, who had gone missing for months, was found. Her remains were found in Massachusetts. And this whole romantic poem took on a whole nother thing, and it's called Blood Street.
It was raining on the red lights on Bloodstraat when I heard they found your remains 3,500 miles away in the woods in Massachusetts. We had only met maybe twice, once during a radio interview for my book, which was new at the time, but not since. You liked my haiku, and I thanked you for that. Now they found your remains 3,500 miles from back there, and it doesn't seem right. Perhaps, like so much, there should have been so much more. Refuge. Shelter. And maybe the rain on the red lights will wash it all away, but I doubt things like forgiveness and mercy in times like these. And I'll leave it there.
Don't
you do it? Here's a question. Writers and poets write for myriad of reasons. Some write primarily to speak a message to their audience. Others write because staying silent is not an option. Mike, why do you write?
Well, I mean, if we're to believe the whole thing, artists of all disciplines being the ones who propel a culture, a society, whatever it might be, forward, or show them a better way, you can't stay silent. Because if you do that, then you're not fulfilling what's inside you anyway, and what people are expecting from someone who considers himself an artist of any stripe or herself an artist of any stripe. So, yeah, you write because silence isn't an option. It just isn't. Whether you're sending out an alarm that, hey, everything's effed up, or you can't stay silent. The days are too fraught. You can't stay silent.
Were you destined to become a poet?
I was destined to do something. A lot of the folks that are involved in, for lack of a better word, the poetry scene around here are always thanking the four or five of us that run the organization for doing what we do in creating a community. So I guess, if anything, I was always meant to create some kind of community or to be part of a community, an active member of that community, to be a voice in that community. So, yeah, I don't know if it was poetry-wise, but yeah, I was destined to say something somewhere. So,
what do you think you've learned about yourself as a result of being a poet?
I think I've learned the honesty. I think I'm a better person for being able to do something, being able to say something. I'm not trying to make it out to be heroic or anything to that nature.
You can look back on
it. It's just that you're basically adding to the story of our time, all right? Whether it's a footnote that you're adding or it's a paragraph, I'm adding something, or we're adding something to our times. And I think that's important. I think we're all meant to do that because we're meant to talk to each other, and this is how we've chosen to do it.
Where can we purchase your books?
You can email me directly. You can go up on the website, www.mikejerkovic.com, which is in terrible need of maintenance. But you can go up there and purchase things that way. You can go up on Amazon. But if you email me directly, I'll get things to you. That's not a problem. It's on Amazon. It's also at Nirala Press, where the haiku books are. And you can purchase my books also at the Calling All Poets website, www.callingallpoets.net. Yeah, emailing me directly or going up to the website is the best way of doing it.
Where do you go from here? What's next for you creatively?
It's always been something that I've done, but over the last 3 months, maybe because I'm not writing the poetry like I was, I've really been delving into what I call forensic photography. And basically what it is, I mean, we all take pictures. We all take way too many pictures. And a lot of those pictures are very nice, and a lot of them pictures are really boring. So I try to take the boring ones and twist and turn them and twist them and turn them until you couldn't tell what the original photo was if you tried, and I can't even remember what it was. So I've really been getting into that. And what's been fun is that those images are matching the haikus. And that's what I've been posting up online. There'll be more of them when we revamp the website in June and July. But that's really what I've been working on, is the images have really been coming fast and furious. So, because there's gazillion years of photographs. So it's like, okay, let's twist and turn this one. But I've been having a lot of fun with that.
Well, Mike, we've reached the end of our poetic journey, and I'd like to thank you so much for being my guest on this podcast. Your poetry is humorous, accessible, and exceptionally well-written. What strikes me the most, though, was listening to you share about your life and how you perceive your place in the world. Your profound statements and the lucidity of your thoughts were truly inspiring. Truly, truly inspiring. You came across as a man of great integrity, and it was an honor to have you on my show. A good man, Mike Jerkovic.
This feeling is very mutual.
I'd like you to return to the broadcast, and next time, bring friends with you. You're always welcome here. always.
Well, thank you, my friend. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. As you heard, Mike's poetry swings. It moves from the sacred to the political, from family tables to social justice, all with that jazz rhythm pulsing underneath. The following 6 bonus poems show Mike's full range: spiritual transcendence, righteous anger, personal history, and pure improvisation with musician Nick Bissons on the final piece, Tender and Fierce, South Bronx and Beyond. 6 bonus poems recorded exclusively for Timeless Classics.
I was building a skyscraper when I ran out of sky and cozied up to the whereabouts of heaven. Above our false hosannas, way up in the clouds where no one speaks but everyone sings beautifully and in tune. Above the movement of money, gunfights and late-stage cancer, grade school body counts and shots per round. Up there, in the blue, beyond wonder, where tomorrow threatens no one, where angels woo the glade. Your North Star still stirs hearts to freedom, but our skies are hazy, barring light. Your North Star still stirs all souls to birthright, but our waters are foul, and some die trying. Your North Star still stirs a life without chains, without scars, but our leaders unpure. Your North Star still stirs the moon to reveal the passage, but her light has been touched by men. Your North Star still stirs the shadows of history looming, but our facts too often untrue. Your North Star still stirs a people's deliverance, a far ways off, but well within sight. My uncle was a hitman, his suits so sharp they drew all that spills from the mortal coil. This may be the day the Lord has made, but he didn't make it with us in mind, he says, on a gloomy Sunday off Jerome Avenue. He was on his way to meet a guy named Sal, he says, as if I knew one Sal from another. Don't feed the boy notions, Mama says, her meatballs musing in a gravy 9 decades down and counting. Let him be a boy, she says, as if she hadn't already told me that men loot rivers and women loot men, and the circle goes round, my uncle said. His top coat packing, his knife with the sharpest edge at his side, the pull of his hands. The charming ineptness you've taken to heart dates back to the autumn of 1882, when, in the crimson goodness of Trinity Church, the first of my forebears panned for poetry and gold amid the gilded squatter. Tipsheet Jones moved about the lower borough like the crackling new current that lit up Pearl Street, like vandal stars fallen from God's busy hands. Through the roil and rumble of a city divining, he ran his book and wrote his verse neath the hanging tree, where the warm and waning afternoon light was the golden cast of God's smile. In his bowler and shabby frock, he took his poems to the hometown newspapers, rashly establishing a down-the-decades pattern of editorial rejection down to me. Yours truly, who as we speak is weighing rejections one by one by one. When pennies proved few from Waverly readings, Tip took whatever poor boy gigs he could gather. Gravedigger, sewer rat, muck diver, and wooed almond-eyed Angelina Francesco into marriage. 3 kids and a lot of talk about better days. Workers not loitering, living like thieves. Their children without factory fever. The 5 points without blood, without cholera. Days when the city no longer digested its Only here in shitholes like this do they steal catalytic converters from Meals on Wheels, roast 51 migrants in an abandoned tractor trailer. Are you free to carry weapons but forced to carry violence to term? Only here are citizens so convinced of their own idiot exception they can't take a friggin' vaccine. Cower with their guns and God, the oligarchs of food, fuel, and false prophecy, gouge and gouge and gorge in pursuit of sucking congressmen who run afoul unfettered. Only here do the others fear their skin. Their children targets. Only here do we believe we are on the verge of great things, but nothing works. Not my dick, the elect, the vacuum, the wireless, the baby food, the underpaid medical staff, the car, the stove, the script, mass transit, dial tone, exchange rate, new app, old meat, sour milk. Only here would you write a poem like this. Roll up your tents, dust off your boots, freaks never scrutinize. Stick out your tongue, extinguish the pool, the sacristy's on fire. Take off your pants, finger your chin, the FBI is looking. She swore she saw Murray the K take off with her boyfriend's wallet. Trim the frost from your beard, the Bronx will always glimmer. Watch Van Gogh in the batter's cage sing Spanish to a squirrel.
Still craving poetry? Hundreds of episodes of The Quintessential Listening, poetry, online, radio, and YouTube podcast are available to listen to or download on iTunes, Spotify, and other streaming platforms. Till next time, take care and let poetry ring somewhere throughout the land.